Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
Because of this delegation, New Hampshire and America are moving again. Your life is going to change for the better, and that's literal.
That was President Biden in Woodstock, New Hampshire yesterday, touting the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that Congress passed earlier this month. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who's been a passionate advocate for infrastructure since first being elected in 2014, wants us to think bigger. And we caught up with the congressman just last hour to talk about the new infrastructure legislation, the roughly $9 billion that the infrastructure bill will be sending to us here in the Commonwealth, and what he hopes to accomplish with it. And I did start by asking him about his passion for this issue. Many folks might say talking about roads and bridges is boring. So why is he so passionate about infrastructure? What makes it so important to him and to all of us?
Well, look, frankly, roads and bridges are boring, but we have a generational opportunity here to invest in the future, to build high-speed broadband, high-speed rail, things that will take us faster to the future, make us competitive with the rest of the world, and things that our grandkids will look back on and say, yeah, I'm proud of my grandfather, my grandmother for investing in that. It's made a difference in my life today.
So I want to play a little sound from you, for you from President Biden. He was next door in New Hampshire yesterday talking about this new infrastructure legislation that's been signed. He seemed to really focus on fixing the existing stuff as opposed to the money in the bill that would go towards building for the future. Here's a bit of what he said.
This is a bridge that has been structurally deficient for years. I'm preaching to the choir, I know. But the fact is, it used to be able to carry 40-ton trucks. Now the bridge is down to 20-ton restrictions. And right now there are 215 bridges in your state, 215 bridges deemed structurally unsafe in New Hampshire alone.
Now, I understand that a lot of the money that is coming to the region will be focused on roads and bridges kind of stuff. But there's also climate change support in here. There's broadband infrastructure, which we've talked about. Why the heavy focus from the president and the administration on the roads part, the bridges part? And does that surprise you at all?
Well, roads and bridges are something that everybody understands. You know, if you haven't been to Europe or Asia and ridden a high-speed train, you don't really know what that means, how much nicer it is, how much faster it is, how much you would prefer to take a high-speed train somewhere than fight traffic or get on an airplane. Likewise, people, you know, are still coming to terms with what climate change means and what we need to invest in to protect ourselves in the future. So when the president is standing in front of an old bridge and saying part of this bill is going to fix old bridges, he's exactly right. That's what we should be doing with the money that goes to roads. If we were to build all new roads, we would just increase traffic congestion. We might have electric vehicles, but we'd just be sitting in silent traffic jams. That's not what we need to do. So when we're talking about roads and bridges, let's fix the old stuff. But when we're talking about things like broadband, rail, climate change, we've got to invest in things for the next century.
You know, thinking about just yesterday, we paid very close attention in Boston to Michelle Wu being sworn in as the new mayor of Boston. And in her speech, she really talked about this juxtaposition of fixing the old stuff. She talked about streetlights, potholes, basic services, and in her phrase or her words, focusing on generational change. And that feels like a lot to do at once. It feels like more than just sort of chewing gum and walking at the same time. How do we strike that balance? And can you do both at the same time?
You can. I mean, look, it is a lot to do, but that's why this bill is so big. And that's why it's got bipartisan support from across the country. We're going to have a lot of potholes to fill, but we also have to catch up with the rest of the world. I mean, look at what China has done. 12,000 miles of high-speed rail line all over that country in just the last 10 or 15 years. Go to other airports all around the globe, and they look so much nicer and more modern than our own. And there are plenty of cities that are coming to grips with the effects of climate change more quickly than we're waking up to it here in America. So Michelle's got it right. This bill gets it right. But a lot comes down to how it's implemented. And so we have a lot of work to do over the next several years to make sure this money is spent wisely.
I want to get really specific for a minute as you think about implementation. Can you give me one road or bridge or physical piece of infrastructure in your district where you look at it and you think, we're going to fix that thing with this money? And maybe one neighborhood where you think, we're going to bring broadband here in a way that it's not here now.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, starting with broadband, there are a lot of kids in Lynn who weren't able to go to school the way that their classmates were because they didn't have broadband. And Lynn is an interesting example because there's actually an overseas, a transatlantic cable carrying internet for huge swaths of the country that comes right into Lynn. And yet apartments down the street don't have broadband service and great little kids can't go to school the way we all should be able to if we have to do it remotely. When it comes to infrastructure, you know, we've had a big controversy in Wakefield recently over a railroad crossing that's probably been there for 150 years. And we just haven't had the money to fix it properly. What we really need to do is replace the crossing completely. There shouldn't even be a crossing there. We should either put that rail line underground or elevate it. So like the rest of the world, like the interstate highway system, you don't have to deal with getting stuck behind a train stop at a crossing. But we're not thinking big. And I think this bill will allow us to think big.
And how long will this take? You know, 3 years from now, is it done? 5 years from now, a decade? How long does it take to do this?
I think that this will take place over the next decade, Tiziana. I mean, I think that we'll start to see the effects of this soon. But to really implement it well, to make the kinds of generational investments that this bill gives us the opportunity to make, we've got to take time. You know, there is a lot of emphasis on shovel-ready projects. We heard that term back in 2008 under President Obama. But the truth of the matter is that sometimes the projects that are shovel-ready aren't the best ones to do. And when you have an opportunity that this bill presents to really make some generational investments, let's step back for a second and think about what our kids and grandkids are going to need 50, 75 years from now, not just what the quick fix is today.
So what is one thing that you know will be noticeably, substantially different for our listeners within the next decade because of this $9 billion?
Well, what I am hoping to do is make sure we invest in high-speed rail so that you can get not just from Boston to New York in, you know, 90 minutes, 2 hours, or down to Washington in three, but out to Springfield in 25 minutes. Imagine what that would do for the Massachusetts economy. If you could get on a train in Springfield and be in downtown Boston in 25 or 30 minutes. And if you were going home and didn't get off in Springfield, you could go all the way to Chicago in about 4 hours. That would be transformative. Never a weather delay, a perfect safety record, trains every 30 minutes or so. That would be transformative, not just for the city of Boston, for the city of Chicago, but for all the cities like Springfield in between.
So what else is it going to take for us to get there? I mean, you're right. Who doesn't want that? So what are the other obstacles to get over?
Well, look, there are always political fights with this. There are always things that people want to do just because, you know, a politician wants a name on a bridge or something rather than thinking big about the future. I'll give you another example that's close to home in Massachusetts. If we had high-speed rail to the Cape, you could get there in 20 minutes. Imagine being able to get all these people who get jammed up on the rotary and the bridges crossing the canal out to the Cape, out to the ferry to the Vineyard or wherever else in 20 minutes without a car, by the way. If we just expand highways going to the Cape, that's just going to put more cars on the narrow Cape roads. It's going to make those cute little towns even more jammed with traffic. So again, there are some people who just want to expand highways and build another bridge. We got to think big. Let's take the time to actually study. No one's even asked the question, what would it cost to do high-speed rail to the Cape and how transformative would it be for all the people who try to get there every summer weekend?
So last question on this, and then I'll pivot with you. Our listeners know that originally this bill, this bipartisan infrastructure bill, was tied to a larger social infrastructure spending package. They have been separated. If the second one doesn't pass, the social infrastructure spending package, will you be happy with what the Commonwealth got in this bill?
Well, I'm certainly happy with what the Commonwealth is already due to receive from this bill. But we need to do Build Back Better. We need to do the whole package. We need to invest in America's people, not just in America's infrastructure. And that's why this next bill is so important. Now, at the moment, it's being held up because some Democrats want to see the cost. I want to see the cost. Of course, we should know the cost to the American taxpayer of making these investments. But I think what we're going to see is that these are wise investments that will have a good return. And they will lift people up. They will get people educated and prepared for the future. They will benefit the American worker and benefit the American family. And those are good investments to make.
So I do want to pivot with you. Usually we get to talk with you on Veterans Day. We didn't this year due to scheduling. But you just introduced a bill looking to address some of the failures of the original GI Bill, first version passed in 1944. Tell us just a bit about that.
You know, some people have said that the GI Bill was the most successful piece of legislation ever passed. It returned about $7 to the American taxpayer for every dollar invested, because by investing in these veterans and saying, thank you for your service, here's a chance to go to college, they had great success. A generation of successful veterans after World War II built the middle class, built the American century. People like me were able to go to school. Look, I would not be here as a member of Congress if not for the GI Bill, because it made possible my education after I got out of the Marines. But what if I told you all that, and then I said that Black veterans of World War II were denied those benefits? They didn't see those kinds of results. Most Americans don't know this. I didn't know this. Even as a recipient of the GI Bill myself, I had no idea that this happened 50 or 70 years ago. And it was a Marine in my office, Mike Devon, who heard about this, saw a study or something, and said, you know, Seth, you should do a bill on this. And that's exactly what we did.
So the full title of the bill is the Sergeant Isaac Woodward Jr. and Sergeant Joseph H. Maddox GI Bill Restoration Act of 2021. We have talked about Sergeant Woodward on the show before, but you picked these two names. Tell people why.
That's right. Well, first of all, let me start by saying that after I wrote this bill, I wanted to find a really important co-sponsor. So the first co-sponsor that I asked to join the legislation is the great civil rights leader in the House of Representatives, Jim Clyburn. And he said I want to make sure that Sergeant Isaac Woodward's name is on this bill, because Sergeant Woodward was traveling home to Winnsboro, South Carolina, Jim Clyburn's home state, still wearing his uniform after being honorably discharged, when a small town police chief forcibly removed him from the bus and blinded him with his nightstick. Naturally, the police chief was acquitted of the crime by an all-white jury. But Sergeant Woodward's horrific abuse prompted President Truman at the time to sign an executive order integrating the armed services. So truly a historic veteran. And then Sergeant Joseph Maddox, he was injured during his service and medically discharged. He was another World War II era veteran. He applied and was accepted to Harvard University right here at home in Massachusetts for a master's program. But when he sought VA assistance from his local office to help with tuition, he was denied. Denied payment because they said they wanted to avoid setting a precedent. So they're two important veterans to name this bill after, because this is exactly what this legislation is all about.
All right. We are going to continue to watch that with you. Glad we had a chance to talk about veterans since we didn't get to talk to you last week. That is Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents the state's 6th district. Congressman, thanks for the time.
Thanks, Tiziana.
Let's play a game. What do all of these names have in common? Change My Mind, Exit 12, Distracted Boyfriend. And if you haven't guessed it yet, how about Bernie Sanders and his mittens? All right, you may have guessed by now that the answer is memes. Today and tomorrow, we're going to dive into two memes with local connections. We're going to do it alongside some people who know a lot about the subject right now. Amory Sievertson and Ben Brock Johnson are the co-hosts of the WBUR podcast, Endless Thread. And this season, Endless Thread is talking all things memes, what they tell us about ourselves and the world around us. We'll be talking with Emery and Ben in a couple of minutes, but first I want to play a piece of sound from the first episode of their season about the origins of the meme Kilroy was here. Now, the first person you're going to hear is Phil Edwards of Vox. In this sound, he is recounting visiting the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. You'll also hear Ben and Emery in there.
It's very beautiful, but I'd heard that there was this secret thing hidden around the corner. And so I go, I'm looking for it, I don't see it.
The it here was not the memorial itself. Phil didn't feel much of a connection to that. It felt too abstract. But this secret treasure he was looking for, that is what drew him to this monument and what moved him once he found it.
And I finally peek around, and over a fence just beyond it, kind of hidden in the corner, is a little drawing. And it's of a man peeking over a wall. His giant nose is kind of hanging over it. And under it, it says, Kilroy was here.
Kilroy was here, hiding in plain sight on the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., a little image with text staring back at him.
The eyes are basically usually two dots. In some cases, they're drawn differently. But two dots, and then it's just a line drawing.
The line drawing is extremely spare. It's this little bald head with beady eyes and a big droopy nose and two sets of little fingers, all peering over a horizontal line that looks like a wall. Even though it's meant to feel like a secret, it's not. The image and text is literally carved into the stone of this memorial.
This was part of the design of the monument from the beginning, and I was really interested in how something so ephemeral as this graffiti could make it onto a monument and actually endure to be like a part of World War II history.
This graffiti was part of World War II history because during the war, this little doodle wasn't just here.
I mean, he ends up everywhere.
Everywhere as in all over the globe. And yet, for a long time, nobody knew why, where it came from. It was just this recurring, mysterious piece of graffiti. Sometimes the text changed, there were different versions of the image, but the basic building blocks were always recognizable.
That was an excerpt from episode one of the new season of WBUR's Endless Thread. We caught up this week with Ben Brock Johnson and Emery Sievertson, co-hosts of Endless Thread, about Kilroy. And I started by asking them their own favorite memes.
I always stand by the Willy Wonka when he has his head rested in his hand and, you know, he's making that expression that's like, oh, yes, do please tell me how hard your life is, that sort of a thing.
And Ben, how about you?
Recently, I've gone back to one that everybody knows, I feel, or at least that's what it feels like when you know a meme, is that everyone else knows the exact same meme, but then quickly you discover that people don't know what you're talking about sometimes when you're describing them. But the one I'm thinking of right now is the dog sitting inside of the cavern that is on fire, and the dog is saying, this is fine.
So let's back up. And I will say, I think if I had to answer the question, it's a pre-internet meme. It is the fact that in the 80s, I saw Andre the Giant's face spray painted everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Great one. Obey.
Yes. Obey. Exactly. So that's the one I think that sticks most for me. So let's back up, because we've just talked about a bunch of them, some from the internet era, some not. Your first episode is about a pre-internet meme. So what is a meme, Emery?
A meme, it's easiest to think of it like a gene, but for cultural information. So it's a unit of cultural information that passes from person to person or society to society, civilization to civilization. And as it passes, it changes. So whether that's the text or the caption changing on an image, or maybe it's a caption that remains the same, like nature is healing, and it's the image that changes. It's a different relevant piece of information that represents nature is healing. So it is just like this little unit of culture that passes and morphs a little bit as it passes.
And that morphing and passing, Ben, is part of what makes a meme like viral and successful versus something that just kind of dies on the vine.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that over time, if a meme is successful, it creates an in-group, right? And sometimes that means it also creates an out-group. But the people who really resonate with the meme, it's in its original form, or at least the form that it's reaching them at, they then take it and remix it, evolve it, put their own spin on it, and continue to amplify it out in the world. And it's really fun to watch them spread, and also interesting and sometimes scary.
So we, I think, in Boston love to pride ourselves on being the origin of many important things. Some might say most important things. And you guys start with this meme that predates meme, right? With Kilroy yep. was here. And it turns out deep local origins and maybe one of the first. So talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, so there's a lot of arguments about what the first meme is. This one, Kilroy was here, is a lot of people agree that this one is really the first meme, or by some measures the first meme. But there are also memes that are even older than this one. This one started just before World War II, as near as we can tell, although it has some older origins as well. But even like in the Middle Ages, monks drawing snails in manuscripts, there are earlier and earlier examples of memes. But Kilroy was here. It reminds me of Ziggy.
Yeah.
Like that cartoon, if that makes sense. Like this kind of like simple line drawing with a sort of bulbous nose peeking over a wall. And it started, as near as we can tell, it started right here in Boston.
So take us there, Amory, to, without giving too much away, but take us there a little bit on how it did start.
Yeah, well, as a resident of Quincy myself, I have to say it started in Quincy, Ben. Not
oh, my bad.
Quincy
my bad.
People
at least
will
I didn't say Cambridge, right? At least yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a shipyard in Quincy where a lot of major vessels were made that were sent out into World War II. And there was a ship inspector there who worked in the shipyard named James J. Kilroy. And his job was basically to inspect the rivets of the ship that were, you know, literally holding the ship together. And as he's going around and inspecting these rivets, you're supposed to kind of sign your name or at least take stock of what rivets have been checked. And the riveters are getting credit for every rivet they put in that ship.
They get paid by the rivet.
Literally paid by the rivet. And so you want the inspector to think that you have installed as many rivets as possible. So James J. Kilroy, the inspector, was literally signing his name in yellow grease crayon. Kilroy was here so that he would know, I already inspected this part of the ship. You guys aren't going to fool me in thinking that you have put more rivets than you've actually put in this part of the ship.
Basically to keep from double counting.
To keep from double counting. Right. And the word is that these ships sometimes were moving out of the shipyard so quickly. They were being made so quickly that normally what would have been painted over, Kilroy was here in the underbelly of the boat, they didn't even have time to paint over it. So some of these ships were going out into battle still with that yellow grease crayon marking Kilroy was here there, which means that this message, which really only meant something to the people making the ships, was then going out into battle and going around the world for the Allied forces in this case to see. And kind of it became almost like a comforting symbol that, you know, an American crew made this ship that's going out into battle.
There's another interesting aspect to it, which I learned in producing this episode, which is some of the people who were building the ships ended up serving, and they would literally build the ship and then get on it and go overseas and serve. Those people end up spreading the meme that way as well. And like Amory said, it starts out as this kind of surveillance tool for an inspector, but it ends up being this thing that people recognize as a sign of friendliness, a sign that someone like them, someone on their side, had passed through. And that we thought was a really powerful and interesting aspect to the meme as well.
So it actually kind of haunted me, because as I listened to you tell the story, the idea that somebody would so desperately feel alone and lost that they would need to find that common bond, that meaning in this bulbous nose peering over the edge of a wall in these three words, Kilroy was here, was actually deeply haunting, I thought.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear you say that. I haven't thought of it so much as as haunting, because I've really clung to what was described to us as a comforting aspect, and maybe as a sign of force, right? My brain was kind of broken open while working on this series when someone suggested to me that even the American flag itself has become a kind of meme, because it means, you know, you could say, no, hands down, it means American, you know, patriotism, but it doesn't mean that to everyone else. You know, we all react to symbols differently. And so Kilroy Was Here, for some people, might have been a sign of strength. Rumor had it that it had been written in, what was it, Ben, like a Joseph Stalin's bathroom stall, or that Joseph Stalin saw it in a bathroom stall.
Yes.
It was meant to be this kind of intimidating, you know, pro-American or pro-Allied forces message, but also to some other people, a sign of comfort, you know, have heart, that there are other people out here who have your back, and we're in this together, and stay strong, even though you're thousands and thousands of miles away from home.
Where it was drawn around the world, sometimes it lasted longer than the GIs' lives, right, who were drawing this thing. And I found that aspect of it absolutely haunting. But memes, I think, so often serve as this kind of unofficial yet very relatable form of communication among regular people, you know, quote unquote, where you can put a feeling or an idea out into the world and it really resonates with tons of people all over the place. And it's not necessarily propaganda, it's not official messaging, but it's actually this thing that people really respond to. And I think, honestly, like the "this is fine, everything is on fire" meme that we were referencing earlier is another example of that. Like, people have felt during COVID, right? Like this thing that, like, it can denote sadness or frustration or dismay or despair just as much as it can, you know, denote a joke or something funny.
So, Amory, let's pick up on Ben's point about the timelessness, or at least the fact that the meme outlived some of the people to whom it was important, and maybe even who etched it somewhere or drew it somewhere. It's still present today. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, I don't know how often it is still being written, but there's definitely, it lives on in a way that there is a forum on Reddit, there's a subreddit, there's a website that's maintained by, I think, someone with connections to the Quincy shipyard, where people are still logging sightings of Kilroy Was Here. I went for a hike in the Quincy quarries the other weekend, and I saw a Kilroy Was Here graffitied onto a rock there.
Wow.
Right. So there's a little magic in it, in that you don't know who put it there. You don't know why they put it there. You don't know where they first saw it. You don't know if they know the story behind it. But it does have this energy behind it, this kind of timelessness, that someone saw it somewhere and wanted to keep it going for who knows what reason, but someone else is going to see that on that rock in Quincy Quarries, and then maybe they're going to write it somewhere else. And maybe they're assigning a completely different meaning to it.
It's also in a Seinfeld episode and an Outkast song, and it's like it gets referenced in a lot of pop culture as well. There's a horror movie that came out, I think, a couple of years ago that was titled Kilroy Was Here. So it survives through pop culture as well, which I think is interesting.
All right. So tomorrow we get to have you back, and we're going to talk about what I guess I have to believe is maybe the most consummate Boston-based meme, which is Scumbag Steve. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. All right. And one thing, one sneak preview about Scumbag Steve, for people who are going to be excited to tune in for our further conversation tomorrow.
Well, it's not just Scumbag Steve himself. He's also joined by his mom.
And that is the fascinating part. Okay, let's stop there. Ben Brock Johnson, Amory Sievertson, co-hosts of WBUR's podcast Endless Thread. You can listen to the full episodes from this season at WBUR.org or download them in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to both of you. I'll look forward to talking to you again tomorrow.
See you tomorrow.
Thank you so much.
This is going to be fun. We are going to spend the rest of the show today with a true New England delight. Dori Greenspan. You might remember her from many conversations we have had with her on this show, especially during the pandemic, because food, or from the fact that she's kind of a big deal. She is a 5-time James Beard Award-winning author of 14 cookbooks, New York Times magazine columnist, writer of the XOXO Dori newsletter on Bulletin, and our baking guru. She is now out with her latest masterpiece just in time for the holidays, Baking with Dori, sweet, salty, and simple. Dory Greenspan, welcome back to Radio Boston.
You know, it's a good thing it's radio because I'm blushing.
Well, you should blush. And listen, I just want to tell listeners to call with their favorite holiday recipes out there. This book is gorgeous. 150 new recipes in here. Jamie baked cookies. I can smell them. What's your favorite holiday recipe for baking? What's sweet, salty, and simple? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Dory, I do hope it's okay. Jamie Bologna is here, producer Jamie Bologna, right in front of us. He tried your newly remastered World Peace Cookies, the 2.0. Chris Siderick, one of our other producers, made the original last time you were here. So can we welcome Jamie?
Please. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Dory. I'm trying one right now.
He's got his mouth
full. I was just going to say, you sound like a man with cookies in his mouth.
These cookies really are the solution to all global conflict. They're delicious. They're incredible.
I love to think that peace is now reigning in the control room.
It is. It is. So, Jamie, I want to take a bite of a cookie because you've been taunting me with this smell. I'm going to take the one with the salt on top while you start talking to Dory about this
recipe. So, Dory, I made these. I did the freezer thing. You know, you're supposed to, according to the recipe, make them into logs and then freeze them. And I baked them today at WBUR. But I did want to ask you, why mess with perfection, right?
Okay. Like
you had these perfect World Peace cookies, and now you made 2.0 versions.
So let's just back up. For those people who have not had a World Peace cookie, Jamie, you really should describe it because you've just eaten it. But it's a chocolate cookie that's kind of a cross between a shortbread, a French shortbread, and an American chocolate chip.
No. It is a cross between chocolate and heaven. Let's be clear.
Oh, it's too bad I can't rewrite my book. I want that.
Cookbook 15.
I have a pencil. I'm writing it right now. Chocolate and heaven. Okay, so forget the shortbread part. It's chocolate, and it has chunks of chocolate in it. And you could use chips, but it's really, the cookie is so much better when you choose a chocolate that you really like, a bar of chocolate.
Yeah, and I got Ghirardelli 60% and just chopped that up, made a total mess of my kitchen. There was chocolate flakes everywhere.
And even some in the cookies. But see, I love when you chop chocolate, you get all different size pieces, and it means that every bite has a different amount of chocolate. And so it just makes you want to take the next bite. The other thing that's in the original and 2.0 is salt. And when I got this recipe, it was the pastry chef Pierre Hermé in Paris who gave me the recipe more than 20 years ago. Tasting that salt was revolutionary. And so, Jamie, back to your question, why mess with perfection? Yeah. Because the original is perfection. Every time I say perfection, I feel like Mary Berry or Prue Leith from the Great British Baking
Show.
These are
appropriately proved and appropriately baked.
That's right.
So I was, a friend of mine, Charlotte Druckman, was writing a book called Women on Food. And she asked me if I would make a version of the World Peace cookie for her book. And I said no, because I said just what you said. Why mess with something that's perfect? The more I thought about it, the more I thought maybe I could, and I've never done this before, find ingredients that matched human characteristics. And so I wanted to think about the characteristics that I really admire in women, and I wanted to find ingredients to match. And they had to also, you know, fit in with the cookie recipe.
Sure.
And so I put in some rye flour for earthiness, for groundedness. I put in a little bit of chili pepper for that bit of unpredictability.
That nice little kick.
And I added cocoa nibs for strength and freeze-dried raspberries because they're kind of sassy. They're a little tart, a little tangy, not as sweet as they are tart. And I thought that would be fun. And I told Charlotte I wouldn't do it unless I loved the cookie. And I ended up loving the cookie.
So, Dory, I'm going to interrupt for a second and just say to listeners, 1-800-423-8255, have you cooked from one of Dory Greenspan's cookbooks? What's your favorite recipe? And if you're thinking about something sweet or salty or cayenne peppery that you're going to bake this coming week, tell us about it. Call us with your favorite recipe, your favorite food. So, Dory, this conversation you and Jamie have been having has been somewhat metaphorical because you had not intended to improve on the world cookie and you had not intended to create another cookbook after the last one that we talked with you about, Everyday Dory. And here we are with a new cookbook, not just like five recipes, 150 new recipes. So what happened, Dory?
You make me sound so untrustworthy. You can't take me at my word. I thought that after the last book, Everyday Dory, I was finished. Because I liked the idea of a baker's dozen. It was my 13th book. But then I had the scone in Santa Barbara. I put it on Instagram. A friend DM'd me and said, you should write a savory baking book. And I started.
Is that the cheddar scone that's in the book?
That's the one. Mm. That's the one that started it all.
Just looks beautiful.
It's also delicious. As I worked, the recipes kept getting sweeter and sweeter. I kept veering from total savoriness into a mix of recipes for sweet things and for salty things. And I also was able to do a breakfast chapter, which is something that I haven't done since Baking from My Home to Yours came out 15 years ago.
So, Dory, the reason I also wanted to ask you that question about why take perfection and change it, because it seems like some of the recipes that you have here in this book do exactly that. It's the classic chocolate chip cookie and you take it in a new direction. Babka, you know, you have these daily breads and tarts, things that we sort of might have known how to make, but then you've tweaked them and played with them. And I'm just wondering, was that a guiding principle for this book?
You know, I think that it's been something I've loved to do from the start. So nothing makes me happier than giving somebody something that I've made and having them look at it like, yeah, I've had that before. And then take a bite and be surprised by something. I love when there's an element of something unexpected in what we make. And I love to play in the kitchen. So you mentioned the babka. It's based on brioche dough, one of my favorite bread doughs. And I use it to make a sweet chocolate babka. But then as I was working on the chocolate babka, I thought, you know, babka doesn't have to be sweet. It could be savory. And so
Blasphemy.
Cheese, right? And I made these cheese swirls and I put some savory streusel on top. And that's, for me, that's the fun of being in the kitchen, of being able to look at something and say, what if I added this? What if I changed the shape? What if I tried another flavor? And to just keep playing.
And Tiziana, that's what I loved so much about this book going through it is like, so Dory, you probably know this. My cooking style is a little more Everyday Dory, your previous book, a sort of shoot from the hip, kind of throw some stuff in here, try that. And baking has never felt like that to me. And so that's why I just love this book so much.
It also, sorry, Dory, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say thank you.
So, Dory, it also got me in trouble a little bit trying something new. I got in a little bit of trouble with Jamie. Jamie can tell
well,
you.
You know, we do these baking segments from time to time, Dory. We all try to bake something, bring it in here to the studio. And here I am. I've got these beautiful World Peace Cookies 2.0. And Tiziana's got nada.
Because, because I made the cornbread, the Whip It Up Quick cornbread. And I finished it and then noticed at the end of the recipe that it basically said, you need to eat this right now for it to be good.
Sure.
And I made it on Monday night. So let's talk about that, right? Because when we really invest ourselves in cooking, we think there needs to be a long tail to that. That stuff was good till the next morning and had to be eaten. And oh, we did. But what if,
much to my chagrin.
Yeah, so talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, I feel like, Jamie, if you want to be angry at someone, I think I should take the blame.
Never. Never at you, Dory.
Well, I'm the one who wrote Eat It Now. So you could have let it sit. But the fact is that cornbread really is good when you've just made it. I mean, you could have frozen it. Maybe it's not all my fault.
Sacrilege.
Yes. See what I'm saying?
Sacrilege to freeze a cornbread.
But her family enjoyed it, so that's fine.
That's
okay,
right.
But here's the big question. Did you love it? Did your family love it?
Yeah, it went fast. And here was part of what I wanted to
bring
back.
What was in it, Tiziana? Yeah.
I want to bring out, because, Dory, there were a couple of things. I am used to a sweet cornbread. So to your point about savory, I put bacon in. I used chive. You said you could use an herb. I went with chive. But it was the cayenne pepper. And when I first saw that, I thought, cayenne pepper in the cornbread. Hmm. But wow, did that create something special.
I'm so glad you liked it. You know, I love playing with sweet and savory. So there's some sugar in the cornbread, and I have it as an optional ingredient, and I give you a range. But I love when there's like a slight little bit of sweetness, and then you get the heat from the cayenne and from the black pepper when you put bacon, bacon is kind of sweet savory in its own way. I think that's really, because that's what keeps you interested. That's what keeps you coming back for another bite.
Now, Dory, one of the things that we both noticed was needing to go out, there were a lot of special ingredients. I don't tend to carry buttermilk or cornmeal. Jamie, there were a couple of things you...
Yeah, like cacao nibs, as you were talking about
earlier. Well, yeah, the 2.0 has some...
The 2.0 or even...
Special stuff, yeah.
I felt embarrassed that I couldn't find freeze-dried raspberries at the first two supermarkets I stopped at, but I eventually...
There's a shortage!
There you go. Blame it all on the shortage. There we go. But I did find myself sort of running around a little bit to get stuff. Do you recommend to people?
Especially, Dory, to add to that, people who just, they don't have the money or the time for really complex baking.
Yep. So I feel like it's the World Peace 2.0 is, I feel, more an exception than the rule in this book. Because, well, I'll tell you in a second, but about the buttermilk, and I don't know if I've written it here or not, you know, you can use yogurt and just thin it with a little bit of milk, or you can use milk and add a little lemon juice to it. So buttermilk is an easy one to sub for. So when I started this book, I've worked on it for 3 years. I thought this was going to be a book where I was going to get to travel around and meet home bakers and professional chefs and talk with them about what they were doing.
Come on to local public radio shows and talk about it in studio. Yeah.
Yeah. But that, and I was able to do that in the beginning. Then it was the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I was home like everyone else. And so most of the recipes were developed during the pandemic and are supermarket recipes. I think of this as my Stop and Shop book. But it is true that there are some special ingredients, and particularly in the World Peace 2.0, expensive ingredients.
Yeah, these flakes of salt that are on top of here, Tiziana, these are like imported from France, kind of.
They taste like it.
Yeah.
Good. But again, I had to run around.
But I'm sorry you didn't call me, because I would have given you some ideas for, you know, a little bit of kosher salt would have given you not as pretty. You'd have to use a little less because it's not as salty. But
I was happy to do it. This is a beautiful thing to enjoy.
Well, but I feel like there are ways to substitute. There are ways. I mean, in the old days when I started writing cookbooks, we didn't have Google. We didn't have, it's 30 years. My first book was published 30 years ago. We didn't have computers. Now I feel like there are resources for, okay, I don't have buttermilk. Tell me, Baker Google, what can I substitute for it? And there are ways to make things that you love. I give a lot of variations in recipes because I know what I love and I know what other people might want. You know, I know what I love and I know that other people might want to play with and change up things. So, there are some that are, chocolate will always be expensive.
So, Dory, I'm going to just quickly ask you about page 273 of the cookbook, which, of course, you probably don't know what right in front of you. But it is a picture of a pumpkin pie and the word marshmallow appears. And given that we have Thanksgiving next week, tell us about marshmallow with pumpkin pie.
Well, so is that not – it's when I was growing up, that's what the bakeries had. Did you – is it not?
No. Of course, I was raised in Michigan, Dory. I've been in Boston about 25 years, but I was raised in Michigan. I was not familiar with marshmallow with my pumpkin pie. Am I just regionally inept?
I mean, everything we ate was from the Italian-American palate, so pumpkin pie was not on the agenda.
So tell us about marshmallows with pumpkin pie.
Well, it's a little bit like marshmallows on top. It's almost exactly like marshmallows on top of mashed sweet potatoes at Thanksgiving. Not Michigan?
That one is. All right. Yeah. So how do you do it? Just tell people a little bit about how do you incorporate the marshmallow?
You don't incorporate them. Don't. Put them on top.
There you go. And bake them, melt them. Straight up?
Yeah, you can. If you have a blowtorch, you can use that. Under the broiler for a little. Julia Child said every woman needs a blowtorch.
I love it.
They can go under the broiler. I once tried to make something, a cake with marshmallows incorporated. Didn't work. And I kept trying. And then somebody who knew more about science than I did said, it's impossible.
Don't try.
So, Dory, can I ask you a question? Because you mentioned a little earlier in the conversation, it's been 30 years that you've been writing these cookbooks.
Yeah.
And what's the next 30 years? What's next for you, Dory?
I don't know. You know, look, and Jamie, as you and Tiziana know, you can't trust me. Whatever I tell you.
Yeah, well, that's why we want it on tape so we can hold you accountable.
Yeah, I might change my mind.
So what are you baking next week?
So I'm doing some kind of just a little different recipes for Thanksgiving. I'm making I have it made and it's in the freezer, the cocoa cranberry Linzer tart. So it's two rounds of essentially chocolate cookie dough, spiced chocolate cookie dough. And it's put around in the bottom of a cake pan. And then it's a homemade cranberry raspberry jam. So it's a layer of that. And then the cocoa cranberry Linzer cookie dough, the cocoa cookie dough on top. Because I've never seen chocolate at Thanksgiving. And I think I want to start a movement that we need chocolate in Thanksgiving.
And you said you're going to do a couple of things. That is the Linzer, which sounds delicious. I'm wondering what else is going to appear. Something maybe on the more savory side, since that's where you started with this cookbook.
So I will be making the cornbread that your family ate. That's for sure.
I've got to make that too, I guess, because I want to try it.
Yes.
And I'm going to make an apple galette, which is not savory, except that. So I've made a lot of apple galettes, and in this book, this happened quite by accident. I had made a tarte tatin that wasn't very successful, and so you make a tarte tatin by making caramel and cooking apples in the caramel. And so,
Dory, we're going to run out of time. So you know.
So it's just applesauce. It's caramelized applesauce with apples on top and a very rustic crust around it.
Fantastic.
So that'll be on my Thanksgiving table, too.
Sounds good.
Dory Greenspan here with Jamie Bologna and me, New England-based James Beard Award-winning author. We'll have recipes on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today, folks. Thanks.
Thank you.